We would rather suffer HB2 than to have this body one more time deny us the full and unfettered protection of the law.
Today, we repealed House Bill 2, and we begin to end discrimination in North Carolina.
It is claiming to be masquerading as a solution when we all know that it's not.
I think my books, at least early on, weren't gay enough. And to the straight world, the mainstream world, they were too gay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. North Carolina fakes HB2 repeal, Sweden compensates sterilized trans people, and crime pays for an award-winning lesbian mystery writer. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered the 29th birthday edition of This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 1st, 2017.
In a perfect world with a good General Assembly, we would have repealed House Bill 2 fully today and added full statewide protections for LGBT North Carolinians. Unfortunately, our supermajority Republican legislature will not pass these protections.
That's North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. Despite his misgivings and apparently believing it's the best he could get at this time, Cooper signed a bill repealing the state's infamous so-called bathroom bill, HB 2, on March 30th. However, the replacement measure would allow lawmakers to reinstate the law requiring trans people to use public bathrooms and locker rooms based on their birth certificate gender at any time in the future. And it also maintains HB2's ban on local governments passing laws that protect their LGBT citizens from discrimination until at least December of 2020. LGBT and other human rights advocates have condemned the so-called repeal for falling far short of that description. The dominant Republican legislative majority was pressured to act by a direct ultimatum from the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, to repeal HB2 by mid-April or lose the state's chances to host all college sports championship tournaments and games until 2022. The NCAA has already joined a number of professional sports associations, entertainers, and business, philanthropic, and faith organizations boycotting the state because of the discriminatory law. As we record this newscast, the NCAA has yet to announce whether or not the new law satisfies its concerns. We'll have much more on this story later in the program on most of these This Way Out stations.
Dozens of LGBT-related bills are still being considered in several other U.S. states, while a few of the most homophobic and transphobic proposals have been withdrawn or rejected. The sponsor of an HB2 clone in Arkansas pulled her bill this week. Republican Senator Linda Collins-Smith's measure stated that bathrooms with multiple stalls in government buildings could only be used by people of one designated gender, which would be determined by what's on each person's birth certificate. Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson was among the bill's critics.
But an anti-trans bathroom bill is still alive and well in the Texas legislature. Opponents say it's even worse than North Carolina's original HB2. And according to a weekly scorecard issued by the ACLU, similar bathroom bills have been introduced or are currently being considered in Alabama, Arizona, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, New York, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Washington. But bathroom bills have recently been rejected in South Dakota, Virginia, and Wyoming.
Bills that would allow individuals or businesses to discriminate against LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief or conviction have been introduced or are being considered in Arizona, Colorado, Hawaii, Illinois, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, New Jersey, Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, Virginia, West Virginia, and Washington. But a so-called religious freedom bill failed in the Wyoming legislature.
HB2-like bills to prevent local governments from enacting non-discrimination ordinances that aren't offered at the state level have been introduced or are under consideration in Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia. none of these states protect LGBT people from discrimination. And contrary to widespread belief, there are no U.S. federal laws that ban bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity.
There's an ongoing debate in U.S. courts over whether or not federal civil rights laws already protect LGBT people from discrimination. A three-judge panel of the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on March 27th that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that bans discrimination based on sex also outlaws discrimination based on sexual orientation because the assumption of heterosexuality amounts to illegal gender stereotyping. The plaintiff in the case, Matthew Christensen, charged that he faced extreme harassment and discrimination from management at a major advertising firm because he's openly gay. A lower court decided, however, that Title VII does not ban bias based on sexual orientation. But Christensen's lawyers argued in their appeal that to discriminate based on sexual orientation can't be separated from discrimination against a person based on their gender. Chief Judge Robert A. Katzman agreed, writing that, if gay, lesbian, or bisexual plaintiffs can show that they were discriminated against for failing to comply with some gender stereotype, including the stereotype that men should be exclusively attracted to women and women should be exclusively attracted to men, that they have made out a cognizable sex discrimination claim. Two members of the three-judge panel specifically urged a higher court to consider the changing legal landscape that has taken shape in nearly two decades and decide once and for all that Title VII does indeed fully protect LGBT workers from discrimination. By the way, Christensen still has his job. His lawyers applauded him for standing his ground in the face of overwhelming abuse. His immediate supervisor and chief antagonist at the ad agency, however, reportedly no longer works there.
The U.S. Census Bureau removed questions about sexual orientation and gender identity this week from those it would be asking Americans in the 2020 survey. Advocates for LGBT visibility had been excited because sexual and gender minorities have never been specifically counted in the U.S. Census. But an official Census Bureau statement a day after the agency sent Congress its proposals for the subjects to ask Americans in the 2020 Census said the material inadvertently listed sexual orientation and gender identity as a proposed topic in the appendix.
And in another betrayal of his promise to protect LGBT people, President Trump this week rescinded an Obama-era executive order that required companies doing business with the federal government to prove that they're complying with LGBT anti-bias executive orders. That included a ban on anti-LGBT discrimination in the workplace by federal contractors.
Elsewhere, Swedish Health Minister Gabriel Wikström announced his government's plans this week to compensate transgender people who were forced under a law in effect from 1972 through 2013 to undergo sterilization in addition to reassignment surgery before their gender identity would be legally recognized. He said the government would award the equivalent of about $26,000 to each of the estimated 800 people affected. RFSL, the Swedish Federation for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer Rights, applauded the announcement. Monetary reparations cannot completely compensate for the violations of forced sterilization, a statement said, but financial redress initiated by the government is an official acknowledgement that these actions were wrong and that the state should not have treated its citizens this way.
Female-to-male transgender high school wrestler Mac Beggs made news last month by winning the Texas Girls State Championship in his weight class. Officials who set the rules for high school sports in the state refused to recognize his transition, which has included testosterone treatments and has required him to wrestle in the girls' category. Beggs didn't like it any more than some of the girls he wrestled, along with many of their parents. But the national organization overseeing the sport, USA Wrestling, approved a policy this week that will not only allow, but require the high school junior to wrestle against boys in any competitions off campus. Begg said he already plans to compete in USA Wrestling's Gecko Roman discipline in the next few weeks. But unless the state policy changes, and observers don't expect that to happen, he'll be forced once again in his senior year in high school to wrestle girls. USA Wrestling has no control over Texas state policy, which says that athletes must wrestle as the gender listed on their birth certificate.
And finally, the week ended on a sad note with the passing of the person credited with creating the world-famous rainbow flag. Friends announced that Gilbert Baker died in his sleep at his home in New York on March 30th at the age of 65. Baker was born in Kansas and served in the U.S. Army, where he said he taught himself how to sew. He lived in San Francisco from 1970 to 1994, before moving to New York. When newly elected San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk asked Baker to create something that would symbolize the community, Baker immediately rejected the often used pink triangle, which identified homosexuals in the Nazi concentration camps, as too depressing. He once explained that flags are about power, and that the rainbow came to mind almost instantly as an obvious expression of diversity and acceptance. The original rainbow flag had stripes in 8 colors, but pink and turquoise were soon eliminated because fabrics and dyes in those shades weren't as readily available as the 6 other colors seen worldwide today: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and purple. The first 8-color flags debuted with Harvey Milk's contingent in the June 1978 San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Parade. As one friend noted, Baker's rainbow flag will endure forever, as will his character in Dustin Lance Black's underappreciated TV miniseries When We Rise, for which Baker insisted on sewing a fresh flag.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending April 1st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Happy 29th birthday, This Way Out!
I'd always read mysteries, always loved mysteries. I thought, wow, that would be something if I could try my hand at something like that.
Don't be clueless. Get to know the world's leading lesbian mystery writer later in the program.
Take my hand and follow me across the mountains to the sea, where there is nothing like the taste of southern hospitality. Along the rivers and the streams, discover just what it means to know what North Carolina means to me.
Put the civil rights and dignity of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and especially trans people on one side of the scale, and the loss of billions of dollars in business development, tourism, entertainment, and especially sports revenue on the other side, and guess who wins? When the pinch in the state's pockets became too tight, North Carolina found a way to repeal its much-maligned bathroom bill on March 30th without actually repealing it. HB 2 was enacted a year ago to prohibit local protections against anti-LGBT discrimination and to ban trans people from using gender-appropriate public facilities. A highly effective boycott, fueled by a wildfire of outrage spread across the country, that even persuaded the National Collegiate Athletic Association to shun North Carolina as a host for the coveted NCAA tournament and championship games. In the state legislature's back rooms where the new bill was born, it was the money that mattered more than the morals, as Mark Miracle of the Pacifica Evening News reports.
The compromise plan by the state's Democratic governor and leaders of the Republican-controlled legislature was worked out under mounting pressure from the NCAA, which threatened to take away even more sporting events from the basketball-obsessed state as long as the law remained on the books. The new measure cleared the House and the Senate in a matter of hours and was sent to Governor Roy Cooper for his signature. But the American Civil Liberties Union and gay and transgender activists complained the new bill still denies them certain protections from discrimination, and they demanded a full repeal.
Pacifica's Eileen Alfandary covered the details of the hurried effort to rid North Carolina of its bathroom bill stain.
The speedy vote in both legislative chambers came after Republican legislative leaders and the state's Democratic governor hammered out an agreement. The new measure repeals the bathroom law's provision requiring people to use bathrooms that correspond to the gender on their birth certificate, but it would also prohibit local governments from passing local LGBTQ anti-discrimination measures until December of 2020. Supporters in the North Carolina House included Republican Sarah Stevens.
This will reset what we do with our bathroom policy. The preemption to cover multi-occupancy restrooms, showers, and changing facilities everywhere in the state of North Carolina should be governed by the state and not by any separate locality, school entity, or any other position.
Democrat Carla Cunningham said she opposes discrimination, but the new measure was a step in the right direction and could bring back jobs for her unemployed constituents.
The jobs that are lost in my district, the homeless people that remain in my district, this bill has impacted them all.
But the measure drew opposition from LGBTQ and civil liberties groups. The ACLU said the proposal would keep anti-LGBTQ provisions of the law in place and continue to single out transgender people. Democrat Cecil Brockman, who is gay, objected to the agreement being hammered out between the Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers without any input from the community.
There were no LGBT people at the table. Not one person in the LGBT community was at the table, was asked to be a part of this discussion. They were completely left out of the discussion. And when you're talking about an issue that affects LGBT people, you would think you would want to hear their opinion.
Deb Butler is the only lesbian in the North Carolina House. She also voted against the bill.
The LGBT community, my community, our families, our children, and the people who love and care for us do not support this bill. And if the stigma and the suffering associated with HB2 continues, then it is the cross of my community to bear. We would rather suffer HB2 than to have this body one more time deny us the full and unfettered protection of the law.
Republican conservatives were also opposed. Representative Jeff Collins heaped scorn on the announcement of the NCAA that North Carolina would not be considered for championship events from 2018 to 2022, absent any change in the bathroom law, HB2.
So now the NCAA is not only calling what legislation we pass, but the time frame we pass it in North Carolina. That's a horrible precedent to set.
In the end, the North Carolina House approved the measure on a vote of 70-48. The North Carolina Senate approved it on a 2-1 vote, 32-16. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari.
As North Carolina's previous attorney general and as a candidate for governor, Roy Cooper was a staunch opponent of HB2. Now as the top Tar Heel, Cooper tried to paint a positive face on the compromise measure.
For over a year now, House Bill 2 has been a dark cloud hanging over our great state. It has stained our reputation, it has discriminated against our people, and it has caused great economic harm in many of our communities. Today, we repealed House Bill 2, and we begin to end discrimination in North Carolina. We begin to bring back jobs and sporting events. We begin to repair our reputation. It's an important step, but it cannot be the only step. We are a welcoming state. Our people are welcoming. House Bill 2 was not. But today, our laws are catching up with our people.
Rights advocates like Chris Scrow of Equality North Carolina saw Cooper's compromise as a glass far less than half full.
We still are prohibiting cities from protecting gay, lesbian, bisexual, especially transgender North Carolinians against discrimination and violence for 4 years. We've heard from transgender North Carolinians, especially today, about the fact that they can't wait 4 years to be protected against that discrimination and violence. This still keeps North Carolina the only state in the country bizarrely obsessed with regulating where people use the restroom. And I just am in a bit of disbelief that Governor Cooper would be willing to back something like this and would push legislative Democrats. You heard how much of a struggle this was for many of them to face the governor's push versus what their conscience told them to vote out, and we ended up with a bad vote.
In the face of such criticism, Governor Cooper admitted the new law's deficiencies and pledged not to drop the crucial issues.
This is not a perfect deal, and it is not my preferred solution. It stops short of many things we need to do as a state. In a perfect world, with a good General Assembly, we would have repealed House Bill 2 fully today and added full statewide protections for LGBT North Carolinians. Unfortunately, our supermajority Republican legislature will not pass these protections. But this is an important goal that I will keep fighting for. This is not the end of our work to make North Carolina better. I will continue pressing every single day to make sure that North Carolina is a more welcoming place.
But Chris Scrow lays much of the blame at Cooper's feet.
It's very concerning that the governor, has the will of people behind him, didn't take that political will and actually push for full repeal. He didn't make the appropriate attempt to take that popular sentiment that he had behind him for full repeal and translate it into votes here. It's a failure of leadership. It is claiming to be masquerading as a solution when we all know that it's not.
So North Carolina's bathroom barricades have come down, but the legislature still has the option to rebuild them. The state will get new jobs, but LGBTQ people can still be fired, and the NCAA is still discussing whether or not to return. All things considered, who won? Multi-award-winning author Ellen Hart has written over 30 mystery novels, including Hallowed Murder, Faint Praise, and The Lost Women of Lost Lake. This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trykle and John Townsend must be pretty good sleuths indeed to track her down for an interview.
In the mid-80s, I was working at a sorority at the University of Minnesota, and I was a kitchen manager. I have a chefing degree, and, and I've always loved that. I knew I wanted to write a book. I didn't know what I wanted to try. I didn't think I'd ever get published. Kate Green, her first book came out. It's called Shattered Moon, and I was just so blown away by it. I'd always read mysteries, always loved mysteries. When I read that book, I thought, wow, that would be something if I could try my hand at something like that. And then someone told me about Murder in the Collective by Barbara Wilson, told me I ought to read it. It was one of the first lesbian mysteries. I started writing. I used P.D. James as kind of a mentor. She always talked about writing within the moral universe. And because I have a degree in theology, although it has not played a huge role in my life, I was interested in that. And I loved that idea. And so I took her books apart. And really, they taught me how to write. And I was able to get my first mystery published. And that was in 1989.
Ellen, when you talk about taking her books apart, what was that like?
I went through every one of her books chapter by chapter and wrote down what happened in each chapter, what were the plot points, the things that we learned. And I started to see the ebb and flow of how she put in clues, how she created tension, how she developed character. In a mystery, everything has to serve the story, even the character development.
When you started writing, was your main character a lesbian right from the get-go?
Yeah.
So you thought, okay, I'm going to have a lesbian detective.
Yeah. I didn't put her in a ghettoized world in any sense of the word. She lives in the larger world. Her best friend is a lesbian, and they are sort of a dynamic duo who goes around solving crimes, and they're interesting and funny, and there weren't any books out like that.
I was
going to
say, this was back, what, in the late 80s?
I think my books, at least early on, weren't gay enough. And to the straight world, the mainstream world, they were too gay. So I wasn't pleasing anybody, but I was pleasing myself. I wanted Jane to be a fully human person whose sexuality was one significant part of who she was,
right,
but not the totality.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have two main characters that you write about. Is that mm-hmm. correct?
Well, I wrote a second series for a number of years.
Okay, so the first series was?
The Jane Lawless series.
Jane Lawless.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the second series?
It was a husband and wife sleuthing team that had a gay son. His mother said to him exactly what I wanted my mother say to me when I came out to her and didn't. And yet for him in this book, it wasn't enough. And they have kind of an adversary relationship early on. And he's in some of the books and not in other books.
When you were younger, before you were writing, who were some of your favorite mystery writers? Would you say that any of them shaped how you think before that? P.D. James, of course, you've mentioned.
I suppose Sherlock Holmes, the Conan Doyle stories. Okay.
Are you into a lot of the poisons?
I've used poisons. I've done a lot of research. I always do a lot of research before I write a book, because if you do something that's wrong in a novel, I mean, you're going to get a lot of mail. But then again, you can do what Agatha Christie did. If she needed a poison that didn't exist, she'd just create one.
Yeah.
So I've done that, too.
I was thinking of Agatha Christie. Yes. And then your love of culinary. We want to talk about your 2017 Mystery Writers of America Grand Master Award, and you've broken the lavender ceiling. What is that award, and you're the first LGBT person to win this award?
Well, it's considered the highest award that can be given in the mystery writing community. I think it started in 1960. Agatha Christie was the first to get the award.
Oh,
other
wow.
people, Graham Greene, Alfred Hitchcock, Stephen King, Sarah Paretsky, just amazing
My
writers.
My word.
Yes. Yeah, oh, it's pretty phenomenal.
Fantastic. Yes. Congratulations
Exciting.
On that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I've always believed that people who love to read, a lot of those people really, in their heart of hearts, want to try writing. And I was certainly one of those people.
And where can people get your books, Ellen?
Pretty much anywhere. I have a website, www.ellenhart.com.
Ellen Hart's latest book is Fever in the Dark. She was interviewed by Dixie Treichel and John Townsend. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V, Carol Myers, and Dixie Treichel and John Townsend contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Thanks also this week to Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle and Eileen Alfandary. Jeanette McDonald performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, with our thanks once again to the folks at WERU-FM in Bangor, Blue Hill Falls, Maine, for their ongoing support, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. And be sure to check out our new video promo for Obama's Rainbow Rain. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email twroradio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, to UUU Nowra, New South Wales, WRFN Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.